Hi, it's Raghu, and I'm back with Nick Polizzi. Nick, welcome to Mind Rolling.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here again.
Again, yes. Nick, for those of you who don't remember, Nick created a wonderful movie called Sacred Science. And we did a podcast around that, which was taking people to be healed down into the Amazon rainforest with very, very incredible beings, shaman that he worked with, and also using ayahuasca as part of this in a very ceremonial way, not in kind of the way, I guess I look a little bit askance at what some of the stuff that goes on here in the West or in America around the use of this particular drug. It's judgmental and it's not real. It's my projection. I just came back from India, so bear with me on all of this, okay? But there is a way that we had a chat last time about your own relationship with ayahuasca that I thought was very, very down to earth and practical about the perspective that one can take with such a very powerful, transformative ethnogen. So there's a part, you know, there is one part in the book, as I said, please do everybody go to the podcast that Nick and I did about a year ago and check that out, because it's an in-depth reading of his experience and putting that whole thing together. But there, let's see, there is something here that I did pick up in the book that I really liked. And it's towards the end of the book, Nick, and you're kind of asking yourself, why do I even sit in ceremony? Just walking these trails, bathing in these waterfalls and streams, and having the Mapacho River itself close by are profoundly affecting my psyche. Heck, I even had one of the most meaningful transformations of my life last night just getting here. I kind of can relate with that. And you say some tribes don't even let non-apprentices drink ayahuasca. Maybe they're right. This medicine isn't for the unanointed. Just give me your own personal view around the use of ayahuasca, and certainly where there's, it's like everything can be used for real transformation and perhaps being used to escape something. Talk about it from your point of view.
Sure. So I think people, especially in my line of work, covering the kind of subject matter that we tend to cover, they assume that I sit in many ayahuasca ceremonies. They think that I'm in a weekend ceremony. I mean, I was living in the Bay Area for a while, and there's like, you know, weekend ceremonies are kind of the thing now. You just kind of go up and do those. I work with ayahuasca once a year max. In fact, it's been a year and a half since I last sat in an ayahuasca ceremony. I take it very seriously. It's not something that I do recreationally, and I don't think it's something that should be done on a regular basis. Now, obviously everybody's different, but I haven't seen through all the friends I have and contacts I have who do it on a regular basis, I haven't seen it producing incredible results in their life. There's a shaman that I hang out with. He's a Pampamisayok, which is a certain type of shaman in the high Andes, in the Asangate region, in the Caro culture. His name is Sebastian, and he has a really amazing way of looking at the plants. He just started working with ayahuasca. It's very rare for someone like him to even be working with ayahuasca because of the region that he's from. But he's approached plant medicines and entheogens the way that his entire culture does, which is with deep respect, with patience. And so, you know, he's 50 something, and I think it's been a lifetime of him asking permission, as he would put it. He asks permission of the Apus, of the mountain spirits, to kind of, you know, work with these plants. And ultimately, after a long time, a decade or two of like asking permission, then a lot of times, you know, someone in these high shamanic roles will start working with these plants. But it's definitely not something that's dove into. It's not something that everybody does. And he says about these Westerners who come down to his country and work with ayahuasca, he's like, most of these people don't even know how to take care of a houseplant. But they come home, they come down here, and they want to knock on the door of the president, you know, the White House of all plant medicines, and expect to get a meeting. And so he's like, it just doesn't make any sense to us. It's reckless. It's not something that we do. And in many ways, it can be hazardous for an individual just to, you know, go from being a New York City dweller, like I was for a very long time, just to walk down into the jungle and start, you know, working with these plants and, you know, expecting that their life is gonna, you know, not be turned on its ear.
Yeah. Yeah. Healthy attitude. For sure. For sure. Yeah. And that doesn't just, obviously we're talking about plant medicine right here, but it also applies to the kind of people that we meet in different situations, especially when we go on these, what's in pilgrimages in India called yatras, which I just was on myself in India and just got back. So I think that discrimination is a very important quality that we need to cultivate. In Hinduism, it's called viveka. And yeah, that's a big suggestion, especially when we're talking about what we're talking about, because it is easy to forget the way in which we need to honor these plants, these people who are working with the plants. Beyond respect doesn't even say it, I think. It's beyond respect. So I really appreciate your point of view, Nick. And this is self-evident through the movie and Sacred Science and the book. So let's talk about how do we, you and I talked before we went on live, about how do we take, because it's something we work with here at the Love Server Member Foundation, the Be Here Now Podcast Network, and Ram Dass, is weaving what we have gotten, in particular these ancient technologies, you might say. I mean, it's kind of a good word, into how we live day to day, and some of the things that come through us that we can actually put into some action that means something. What is your experience with some of what you've witnessed, experienced in the jungles of the Amazon that have really, you've brought it back in a way that's really done something for you personally in your day-to-day life?
Well, you and I were talking about this before the call, that there's this way of being. In fact, they call it, you know, the healers that I work with down in the jungle, they call it the way of being, where there's this, you know, connection to everything, this, you know, existence in the present moment, this emptiness, blank slatedness of the psyche, so that you can absorb all the information that's going on around you and kind of get out of your head and into the present moment. Not much unlike other traditions in the Far East, and, you know, here in the New World. So something, when I come back from the jungle, one of the biggest challenges that I have is preserving that way of being. You and I were talking about that before we got on the call. It's just that, you know, you're in that mindset of, like, it's very easy to be centered, cool, calm, collected, you know, completely oneness, consciousness. There's one thing, you wake up and you live and you breathe it, and then you come back here into the modern world where there's all these trappings to kind of get you segmented and fragmented and, you know, tugging you in different directions and definitely playing on your ego and all this self-importance. So I, through this kind of challenge, you know, this reintegration challenge that I tend to experience, I've started trying to figure out how to hold on to that way of being in this crazy world in which we live. And I think that the underlying theme to all of it is that, and this is no offense to you, you were just in India and I go to the Amazon all the time, but when we go somewhere else to do the work, it's problematic, because then you come back here and all your patterns are sitting here waiting for you. You know, your life here is sitting here waiting to greet you. So you go somewhere else and you have this experience and it feels like you've finally arrived, and then you have to come home and talk to your mom and talk to your dad, hang out with your kids and all that stuff that, you know, can trigger all these deep things in you. So something I've been trying to do, and it's actually been very interesting over the last year and a half of really putting this into practice, is trying to create this environment and this perspective on this life and on my daily life as being the medicine. Like, this is the medicine. What I have in front of me is the medicine. You know, ayahuasca is a medicine. It's something that some people use, and some people use way too much. But there is plenty of medicine around you in any given moment, you know, if you're willing to look at that, look at your life that way. And you could even go as far as to say, as every life event that happens around you could be taken as a medicine or a poison. You know, ethnobotanist Richard Evan Schultes has this famous quote that the difference between a poison and a medicine is dose. So it's almost like you could look at the way that you're interacting with your life and how much you're opening up yourself to what's in front of you, and the way that you're actually compartmentalizing that and letting it flow through you as either poison or medicine. So I've been really experimenting with, and this is, again, none of this is very original. This is stuff that I'm sure could be found in every major, you know, mystical tradition around the world in some way, shape or form. But I'm starting to kind of go by this mantra of, this is all medicine. If I'm here and I'm actually present, then there's no reason to go somewhere else to kind of do the work. I can be doing the work all the time right now.
Ram Dass wrote a book called Grist for the Mill that fits that whole thing, Nick. So,
Grist for the Mill. I got to write that down. Literally writing it down right now.
Yeah. Well, it is a great book, everybody out there, actually. It's exactly described. Nick described the book just now. Okay. I will say one thing, though, you know, having just come back from India and being in, you know, the Himalayas and like going to the rainforest and being with the divine presence embodied in a couple of different people. And there is a way, and I've been going back and forth. I mean, the last 6 months, I think I've spent almost two in India. So I've really, which is not normal. I usually go there for a few weeks a year. Mm-hmm. And but I've been going back and forth forever and always encounter this, the exact thing that you just mentioned, which is first resistance to being back into the pull, you know, where your desire systems, your attachments, your revulsions, they're all like on hyper speed, and, you know, and they're coming at you. And so there's resistance, and then ultimately a little bit of surrender creeps in, that this is just, you know, one side of the coin, other side of the coin, back and forth until you can't tell. It's a spinning thing. And but there is one thing that's true, and I think you'll agree that there's something that happens when you devote that kind of time to the moment, to being completely present. I mean, and we can say it in a billion different ways, but being completely present. I mean, for me, there are moments when time and space no longer are there, especially being with these shaman. They're living in a world that they have let go of being caught in duality to a great degree. So obviously the more advanced the person is, then the more that ocean of presence is readily available. That sticks with you, even if it's very deep. You know, each time that I have come back from, it's like going to a retreat. I mean, certainly you can do that by just going, for me, going to a retreat for a couple of weeks, a meditation retreat, say in America, I always say this. Yeah, by the end of it, I would come, that presence would be there. Mm-hmm. A lot of work, though, like 12 hours, 14 hours a day meditating. Do I want to really do that? I'd rather just go plug in with one of these guys. Or in the past, for me, it's been this incredible woman saint named Siddhima, who just passed a couple of months ago. So, yeah, so I'm lazy. So going in and plugging in seemed like a much better idea. But there is always a certain deep essence that stays with you and informs the day-to-day. It gives you a little bit more spaciousness. So eventually, as I said, when you first get back, you're really like just absolutely hustled by everything and resisting it. And then there's a little, that spaciousness creeps in where, yeah, it's okay. It's just okay. And you're not resisting. And, you know, there's much more of a flow. So I think you... knowing you as much as I know you now, we've had, you know, a bunch of different talks and so on, that this is something that is very true for you in terms of what you have brought back after and bringing these people. The other thing that you have done, which is really to be congratulated, is the kind of offering that you've provided these people and access beyond getting their health squared away, but just in general being able to taste something that really that is a completely transformational point in their lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the idea of wandering into a very unknown environment and witnessing the very pure ways of an ancient culture that's still very much intact is a wake-up call to a lot of people. I think folks start realizing that they too have roots that they've forgotten about. It's really interesting. We Americans especially, we're so, I don't want to say disenfranchised, but we don't really have connections, strong connections to where we're actually from, you know? And so we just kind of, we're sort of this melting pot, social studies kind of class, kind of a term, but we're this melting pot of cultures, and sort of we end up not really resonating or really relating deeply to the ancient ways of our own people. So we look at these other traditions and say, wow, it's amazing. These ancient cultures are so exotic. Well, at one point, every one of us comes from a lineage that practiced folk medicine because that was all there was. And we practiced mysticism because that was all there was. So it's really interesting, I think, to watch people wander into these cultures, experience what's going on there, and then start asking questions of their own lineages and their own lives and start diving into those parts of themselves that have been so long forgotten.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. There's something nice you say when we were talking about the relationship to ayahuasca. Just you talk about you're afraid because you lose yourself in the circle, which is can be said in so many different circumstances. I was just in one with this, you could call him a shaman. He's a jungle yogi who's gone beyond duality to some extent. I wouldn't know quite far, but sitting there is no, this certainly time and space have evaporated. Some people came with me to, I said, well, you can come along with me. You want to meet somebody like this? Similar to what taking people a little less intense because of the health issues. Mm-hmm. But there was exactly that. There was fear that came in because some part of that thing that you relate with as your identification like evaporates a little bit. This is without taking ayahuasca, mm-hmm, or any drug. And that causes fear. And that's an incredible thing to recognize, is it not? I mean, if you can have enough mindfulness and awareness to just see, okay, all right, I've held on to this thing so tightly for so long, and where's it going, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a pretty far out thing. It's one thing to see, feel, and hear disturbing things, demons, shadows, your own self-talk. Mostly your own self-talk will do it. But tumbling through the darkness, suffering without knowing who or what you are, that's a different kind of terror. It becomes so strong that you have to fight for each breath, and there's no escape once it starts. That's great. Great little piece of writing there that really says it all. I love that.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, that's how it feels. that is how it feels. And the thing I think I want to, I'm always trying to clarify with our folks, is that is something that that's a experience working with ayahuasca that I'm writing about there, but I've had similar experiences to that in a sweat lodge. You know, I've had similar experiences to that in other types of ceremony, you know, that do not in any way involve a hallucinogenic plant. So I'm always trying to reiterate that. And like you said, you were in the presence of someone who was holding that space in a certain environment, and the same fears were faced. It's the fear of the unknown, you know, the fear of the unknown that we're so scared of. And I think that I'm not really ashamed of it anymore because I still get triggered by the unknown. I think we all do. And I think if you didn't, then there might be something wrong with you. I mean, I think it's just part of how we're wired as human beings. But, you know, there's a little bit of our survival instinct, might be a little bit of what's of that, that, you know, that silver cord that they say that connects your soul or your astral self to your soul, to your physical self. Maybe it's all kind of part of that, keeping you here for this particular moment in time. That is kind of, I'm not pretending to know why it happens, but I do know that it's always there. I've tried to get rid of it for a long time, and now I've just learned to forgive myself for sometimes getting stuck on it.
Being human. That's Jack Kornfield. We're human. It's okay. That's what Jack always says. But at some point, this goes to me back to trust. You start to trust that intuitive part of yourself, and that eventually grows into a kind of faith where mm-hmm. you don't give a shit about the fact that you have that fear. Or I think I just said this on another podcast, but I don't care. This bears repeating every damn time because it's so great. So this particular, this yogi, the Jungle Baba, that I've been spending time with on and off and when I go to India. So he went to the jungle when he was like a teenager, like 12, 13, 14, something. He took off. That was it. He tried to get away from his parents, a little village in India, and they keep catching him, bringing him back. Anyhow, he finally got away, and he went off into a jungle, and he went into a cave to meditate. And he did this on and off for 20 years. So I said, so now you go to this cave. You have, first of all, you have no food. You have no nothing, right? You know, there's wild animals and crazy snakes and God knows what in this environment. So what about fear? And he said, yeah, when I first got there, I had that feeling. But he said, then suddenly I realized the cave is Ram, God, Ram in Hindu thing. The wild animals were Ram. The insects were Ram. The snakes were Ram. Everything. The fear was Ram, he said. Right. So that's where you've gone beyond duality. And there is only that one thing. And however it manifests, it's all Ram, you know. And I think that's a great, it's obviously, yeah, get into a cave for about 20 years and maybe, you know, you might come out the other end or, of course, it might take a bunch of lifetimes for you to even have the thought and the balls to go in there without any food or anything and just sit there. But I think the practice is a real part of what we're talking about and working on ourselves on a day-to-day basis with that realization really addresses fear. And now in the book, there's something else that is right around what we're talking about. I think you quote a Buddhist mystic saying the root of all fear is death. And the goal of all religions is to help humans to overcome that fear, which is very, very true. Tell the story about Gary that happened when you brought these people to be healed into the Amazon forest. Can you tell that story? Because I think it's a really important story.
Sure. Do you want me to tell the ultimate story, or do you want me to tell like the entire story of Gary? The ultimate story. Yeah. Okay. So Gary,
Want the ultimate here.
I don't want to waste your time. You know, precious. Gary came down, he had severe advanced neuroendocrine cancer. And we went to visit him in Garibaldi, and he was already in pretty bad shape. We knew that this was gonna be a serious trip for him to make. He didn't have a lot of time left, and he didn't have enough money to continue the treatment. That's essentially his situation. He didn't have enough money to continue the treatment that was sort of barely kind of semi-working, not really working that well. So he came down and he had this, I'm just giving a little brief overview. I'll get to the ultimate.
No, that's good. That's good.
he had of all of our patients, we had plenty of patients that were really sick, but he was by far the most dire, and he at the same time was also by far the quickest to acclimate to this harsh environment that we were in. He fell in love with this place immediately. It's the happiest guy that you see it in the movie, and we talk about it in the book, but the happiest guy, he's just, he's absolutely in heaven. He goes from not being able to walk very well without a cane to, starting to walk, wander on the trails. By day eight, he calls me out to his hut. The huts, by the way, are extremely remote. They're not near each other. They are, in their own secluded little pockets of the jungle. So he's out in his little pocket of the jungle, one of the most remote distant huts, because he requested that one. And he calls me out and he's like, listen, Nick, I'm not bullshitting you. Like, I usually have severe pain across my midsection because, these tiny tumors form as part of this condition in the intestine. And the tumors really, really cause a lot of discomfort. And he's like, I'm usually like just in a severe amount of pain for most of the day. And I woke up today and the pain's gone. He's like, I don't know what to say. He's like, I think that they might be, we might be actually getting somewhere here. And we were stoked. I mean, this is like amazing. This is insane. This is our patient who, who's up against the most severe odds of any of them. And he is now saying that he's had this transformation. It's like, this is insane. He's super excited. I remember just having that powwow with the team and with some of the shamans and some of the faculty at that point afterwards. We're like, is this really happening? Like, is this really happening for him? So that night, we are kind of backing up our footage and doing all the things you do behind the scenes with the documentary film crew as, the rest of the place is kind of winding down and we're in our little longhouse was assigned to us, just doing our final nightly activities by candlelight and headlamp and all that stuff. And the walkie-talkie kind of squeaks on and it's Cynthia, who's one of the aides, who's kind of stays on hand, wanders the trails throughout the night to make sure that the patients are okay. And she's like, you got to come out to hut six immediately. And so that was Gary's hut. And so, yeah, I mean, I could tell you the whole unfolding. And basically, I went out there, ran out there, and Gary was on the front stoop of his hut and, wearing nothing besides a pair of like boxers, I believe. And he was just kind of, sitting there trying to catch his breath, and Roman and one of the doctors and one of the nurse attendants was out there too with him, and he was just having a hard time breathing. And I remember him like looking up and saying, "Hey, Nick." And like, that was then I'm like, "Hey, what's going on? What's going on, Gary?" It kind of went over. And then he like, he said, "I just can't breathe." And then like, he like just fell forward and we caught him and laid him on the ground. And we sort of went through a series of attempts at resuscitation. Ultimately, one of the shamans stepped forward and was like, "He's gone. He's gone. Let's bring him inside his hut." And I would even say, there's obviously a sense of desperation on our side, an urgency, a sense of panic, and everyone's doing the right thing, everything's being done perfectly, textbook. But the mentality when you're trying to save somebody's life is pretty urgent. It's pretty, I don't want to say panicky because that isn't really honoring the way that it felt, but it's just that there's something very serious. There's something, it's a stressful environment. But these shamans are just standing there, standing around watching and they're helping. But then once he's gone, it's not like this thing has happened. We've been defeated by, mortality or something like that. They were like, well, he's gone now. Now let's move his body into the hut because this is the next thing we should do. And I just remember that experience of like picking him up, putting him, bringing him inside of his hut, and there's candles lit all around, and us just watching, his body for a while, by candlelight in silence. And there was just this amazing thing that sort of transpired that I can't quite put words to, that I think a lot of people listening probably have experienced when they've been with loved ones who have passed away, where there's just that moment where there's still something there, even though they're not breathing anymore. There's still something there, even though their heart no longer works. And then there's this thing that is, impossible to describe that just happens where, there's this departure of a soul out of the body that everyone in this situation, probably because the shamans were holding it down, there was this insane, like, departure, soul departure that happened in front of us. And it was incredible. And it was that people, everyone started smiling as they witnessed it. It was this beautiful thing. It was not something to be mourned necessarily in that moment. It was something that was just, we were witnessing something truly incredible, almost like witnessing a child coming into the world, but the other way around. And it was, it just completely turned, it transformed any everything or any remaining stagnating beliefs I had around death and mortality. It really was just this incredible thing to behold.
Amazing. Yeah, it's such a far out experience to read. And you'd go on to talk about how Westerners shelter ourselves from death and dying at any expense.
Oh, man.
I mean, it's pretty far out, isn't it? I mean, because, of course, I've seen a ton of that being in India so much. Mm-hmm. And the attitude is just so way, way different from us. I mean, it's just an amazing juxtaposition between the way that we live and the way that we could live. Mm-hmm. And look at you. You went and this happened. That's got to be one of the most profound turnarounds of direct experience related to death and our fear. I mean, we're actually doing a retreat in Maui coming up in a month, or less than a month, actually, with Ram Dass Krishnadas. We're going to have Roshi Joan Halifax there and Frank Ostiseski and Robert Thurman, you know, all of them deep experts with Ram Dass on that process. And it's called No Death, No Fear. It's what we're talking about right now. And just a matter of, I mean, your direct experience would be, we'd love for everyone to have that direct experience. Mm-hmm. God, it would go so far to changing the fear factor. By the way, that No Death, No Fear is Thich Nhat Hanh, and he wrote a book around that. And which people definitely get that book. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, and there's some people in this culture like Ram Dass that has put a lot of work into taking just changing conceptually our point of view around death and dying and the fear of it is. So this from your book is to me one of the great things in the book because. You can tell that your relationship with that direct experience is so real. I just love it. It's really, really great.
Yeah, it kind of led to a lot. I mean, that idea of no death, no fear leads to a lot of questions. You know, I mean, you start really getting down to the root of all fear, of all concern. I mean, I might be mistaken, but for me, it seems like most of my concerns come down to fear of... not abandonment so much. I guess sometimes fear of abandonment, a fear of exclusion or fear of death itself. If you're like actually on a treacherous mountain hike, we talk about that a little bit in the book. And it was actually fear of dying by, you know, just right in front of you. But there's also, you know, what happens if I, you know, fear of failure can be linked to fear of dying. Because if you think about a creature that fails in the wild, you know, that they're not a good hunter. They're not a good provider. They can be relegated, let's just say, by their tribe and kind of abandoned to sort of die out in the middle of nature, which really does all end up in being a fear of death. I mean, you know, abandonment really is still a fear of death, you know, fear of
alone,
being alone. Yeah. It's fear of death. I mean, in a way, yeah. Because you know, the idea is like, you know, we're a pack, we're a tribe mentality, you know, being alone really does feel very close to death because you theoretically can't provide for yourself if you don't have other folks to support you in a community to kind of rely upon. So it's really interesting when you kind of start tracing out these fears to what they ultimately represent.
Yeah. There's a great quote in the book, actually. I'm just looking for it. I don't know if I'll find it. Just around that. Where the hell is this?
I love that you have my book in your hand and you're flipping through it. I wish I had. I've got my computer sitting on one right now.
That's what I'm supposed to be doing, right? anyhow, it is about, I can't find it right now, but it is about what we do to ourselves in relation to separation and isolation and creating the us and them. Of course, the us and them that's going on in our culture right now is really pretty horrendous. Here it is. It's from Sandra Ingerman, who I've never heard of.
What? You don't know Sandra Ingerman? I have to introduce you to Sandra Ingerman. She's
incredible. Please. Yeah. We are not separate. Rather, we are connected to one source and to a web of life. Imagine a hand where one of the fingers drops to the floor and thinks it can have an independent life without being connected to the body. That is what is happening today.
So good.
Sure is. Humankind is acting like separate fingers that have forgotten the connection to the original source of life.
So good.
So that's the fear of death. I mean, that mm-hmm. that when we are so convinced that we are separate, that there's no way that you wouldn't be afraid of being completely, as you say, abandoned and isolated. Mm-hmm. As we pass into to the mystery. And that's the other thing is, you know, Roshi Halifax talks a lot about honoring that mystery is extraordinarily important.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, shying away from it. Yeah.
You know what, you just kind of triggered me because I realized I've been doing something lately that is like my next little bit of work, let's just call it that, where when I'm in public places, like in a grocery store, I don't always like acknowledge the person who's walking down the aisle. You know, I'll be like, you know, in front of me, you know, I'll just be like, oh, I don't want to engage with that person.
Yeah.
Because I'm in my own thing and I just don't want to, and I don't even know, they might not be nice, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like I've been noticing these weird conspicuous things. I just moved to Boulder. Maybe it's because I just moved to a new place, but it is that I and thou, like that separation kind of the thing where it's like, you are not me. No, you're clearly something that's not me. And looking at you and smiling and just kind of like giving you some kind of sign that I recognize and appreciate your existence is too much. So it's like, thank you. Cause I just got that I'm behaving like a finger that's fallen off the hand. When I'm
You know, in India, one of the great things they do, at least in the rural places, you know, not quite like when you're in Delhi or Mumbai, it's like if I'm walking in the Himalayan foothills and somebody's coming from the other direction. Jai Sia Ram. Hare Krishna, you know, whatever. It, depending on where you are, is who you focus on.
Yep.
But everybody, or it's just namaste, you know, which has become like a stupid ass Coke commercial kind of a thing in America.
Amazing.
Oh, God. But yeah, just that breaks through everything in one fell swoop. In one moment, you're on a different level with that person. You are not in our separate things. We're in the divine presence, you know, Sitaram.
Mm-hmm.
And just the principle, male-female principle. So, yeah, that makes it a little bit easier. Yeah, another quote. You got some great quotes in this book, which speaks to what we're talking about. Walking, I am listening to a deeper way. Suddenly, all my ancestors are behind me. Be still, they say. Watch and listen. You are the result of the love of thousands. Linda Hogan.
So good.
Chickasaw Nation writer. Yeah, I don't know her either. That's fantastic.
There are some extraordinary, extraordinary people that I come across just in the research that I've never heard of before. You'll be reading an academic text, or you'll be reading, you know, just whatever one of the hundreds of books that have been written, but never really, you know, that are no longer in publication. You're like, who is this person? They were clearly connected to, something much deeper than what's being talked about.
Yeah, and I wish we had more. It's not more access because anybody can have access. I wish we would honor them more the way that I'm used to when I go to the East. The way they honor wise people, teachers. And unfortunately, as modern times have taken over India as well, there's so many charlatans that it's very difficult for people to really connect with a pure emanation of the divine presence. However, you know, they don't need to be enlightened, but they need to be putting themselves second, not first. And that sounds easy, but it, you know, very few people do that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Which is really what we're talking about here in the work that you're doing, and what we have become, we who have been with Ram Dass and been to India and been with Neem Karoli Baba, you know, who said, and there's something in here about feeding people. That's a great other quote. But someone asked him, okay, how do I raise my kundalini so that I can become enlightened? You know what he said? Feed people.
So good.
Right. So it was always that. Serve mm-hmm. people, which is why this is called Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. So just thinking of that, Nick, just the idea of getting out of ourselves, and as a first step, a long way to go, but as a first step to really cutting through the feeling of separation that we have, most of us, a lot of the time. And you talk about rewiring our reality, and I love that that phrase. Let's talk about from your point of view and your experiences through going to the Amazon and being back and the kind of work you're doing. How have you started to rewire your reality based on these kinds of incredible experiences in your life?
So when you watch the movie, when you look at what goes on in these cultures, the most the shiniest object that you could sort of focus on is the shaman, medicine man, medicine woman, and these really earth-shattering magic potions that they sometimes administer that, you know, give you a really serious experience overnight. I think that's sort of the illusion. I mean, it's all part of the illusion. When you look deeper into what's going on, if you want to look at what we did with our patients in our movie and in the book, it's much more, it's less exciting than that. It's much more of a daily practice. So one of the most important things I think that happened to us, and one of the most cathartic things for our patients, was just removing every device, every bit of distraction they could pour themselves into. And I think we might have gone into this in our last conversation, so I won't hang here too long. But in terms of what I do in my own life to help, you know, maintain that connectedness, that way of being, is very limited access to devices on a regular basis. I don't really do much besides my work. You know, I do my work and then I'm with my family for the most part. So, I mean, it sounds boring, but there isn't a lot of news in my life. You know, I don't consume like news on a regular basis. I'm not sucked into the Trump thing. I couldn't tell you what happened with Trump over the last 24 hours. I try to stay connected to what the big things that are happening over the course of, you know, a month, you know, but I mean, I'm not going to be able to reiterate to you, or I'm not going to be able to regurgitate, you know, what just happened, the latest thing that everyone is kind of texting and tweeting about. Again, I'm just telling you what I do. I'm not saying that anything is right or wrong, but I am not connected to that kind of stuff. I'm connected to my family. I'm really doing a lot with my sons right now. You know, I've got two little boys, and now we are spending a lot of time understanding the natural environment around us, going hiking in the mountains, making food together, and then I work my butt off for 8 hours, and then I go back to that. So I do it. The distractions I have are pretty much my laptop and the books I'm reading for research, but I try to keep that to an 8-hour window. And the rest of the time is just me being with my family and being connected to what's going on around my environment.
And you really don't miss hearing all of the details of Mr. Trump. How could you possibly live? How can you live?
It's so weird. It's so weird because I am plugged from it, but my family is still so plugged in.
Oh, really?
And they want to kind of have it as part of our conversation. And yeah. I just, at some point, the people, and you know, some people, I think the fear about unplugging is that you're not going to be able to have this conversation with the people anymore. And this is sort of like part of the, you know, demonstration of your intelligence and your responsibility as an adult. But at some point, when you stop knowing what's going on, people stop talking to you about it. Yeah. People know that calling me and talking to me about current events, you know, is not really going to get them anywhere. And again, I'm not saying, I'm not necessarily advocating for everyone doing this. This is just my thing. I'm experimenting with my
habits. No, that's bullshit. If you want to rewire your reality, folks out there, cut that news cycle right off where, you know, you're going to, I mean, I'm talking to myself, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have not done that. Well, I did that when I went to India. I thought, wow, this is another world. This completely pristine. It's like going into a pristine forest. You know, but rewire. That's one great way to start rewiring. And I love that.
There are these conspicuous things that we do, you know, and when you step out of it, you come back in, like you just are, you're reintegrating right now. And things that you have been engaged in, things that we do culturally become far more conspicuous. And you have a very precious little window of time during that reintegration period to write those things down and to make sure you remember that they're conspicuous.
Yeah, right.
After a while, they're not conspicuous anymore. They're just part of it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. News. It's like the wallpaper. It's just the wallpaper.
The wallpaper. Exactly. So the news and the addiction to news and the fact that every single thing that pops up, you know, in news, you know, if I started looking, because I'll sometimes look for it. I'll be like, okay, you know, I should probably find out, make sure the world's still not on fire. And I'll go online and every news headline is fear. It's all fear. It's fear, sex. And I'm like, this is so, I mean, I hate to say it, because I hate the word, but it's so freaking cliche. It's like what we were talking about in the early 1980s, the movie, The Network that came out.
This is
so old. It's just so obvious. Like, is this really what it is? It's fear and sex, fear and greed. And it's every single one. And I'm like, this is just, wow, this is what's going on right now. So that becomes very conspicuous. And so, yeah, I just unplugged it and my wife followed suit and we are now the couple at cocktail parties that might be dull because we can't talk about what happened with the Kardashians. The other thing that we do that I do a lot is, and this is hard, this is harder, is I grew up telling a lot of white lies. And I think that I say that I used to be ashamed saying that until I realized that everybody tells white lies and they're such an amazing indicator of things that are going on underneath the hood. Like, I mean, it happens all the time. I have friends, you know, I had this conversation with somebody who admitted it to me on Saturday because you open up the window to that. People are like, they feel comfortable telling you that they told you a white lie about their location. It's like my wife will call me and she'll be like, hey, you know, where are you? You were supposed to be home 10 minutes ago. I'm tempted to tell her that I'm going to be home in 2 minutes, even though I know it's 10. It's a white lie. So I'm trying, I tune into these little white lies and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So I guess one thing is taking away distractions. The other thing is looking for beacons or little alarm bells that are going on in your reality. Not necessarily because things are crashing to a screeching halt, but just little things that are like usually kind of a little sprout on the surface that needs to be followed down to its root that will lead to some great piece of work that might be painful to handle in the moment, but will ultimately help you you know, weed your inner garden, so to speak, and, you know, and harvest a much nicer crop come harvest time.
Yeah, well, rewire our reality? Well, try telling the truth day to day.
Yes.
Okay? And have, you know, so awareness and mindfulness, by the way, is the root of a great practice because you can see your motivations if you get yourself. You do need to have a bit of a meditative practice because you got to get to a point where you're out of your mind and you're not completely at the beck and call of that monkey mind. Try telling the truth. Maharaji told Ram Dass, tell the truth, love everyone, and tell the truth. He said, oh, I can't love everyone. I don't love anyone, everyone. So that's the truth. Oh, conundrum.
That's
for
amazing.
Sure. Yeah, right. Oh God!
Can I toss another one your way? Just while we're on it, just real quick.
Yeah.
Another thing that I'm on like the prowl for this one these days, and you can tell by the way I speak that I'm by no means a guru. I'm just an average white dude from Connecticut trying to make my life work using some ancient practices to kind of just achieve some semblance of presence and peace and awareness in the moment. So another thing I do a lot is these days very big is asking myself, where is the one really hard conversation that I haven't had with someone else? Where's the one conversation that needs to be had that I'm avoiding, like the plague? Because I do it. And again, I have this thing where I think I'm the only one. I write, like, I wrote that book and I'm like, oh my God, I'm writing all this stuff about me. And then everyone's like, no, I do all this stuff too. I have the same thing. It's human condition. We have conversations we don't want to have because they're painful. Well, where is that conversation? Which one is it? Like even right now, I'm like, oh yeah, which one is it? Because I've been having a lot of them lately, and it's great. It just feels like this like you have them and it hurts when it's, but usually it's not as bad as you think it's going to be. And then sometimes there's this amazing connection that happens during the hard conversation. You, the other person is allowed to then tell you how they feel. And then you feel even more love for them because you established this, this link and this, this trust and this space, safe space. But it's hard. We avoid it like the plague. We avoid, and I'm not sure we could dive right into why we do that, but we do it with family members, with friends, with colleagues. Where is the one conversation that I have not had that needs to be had that I know is going to probably hurt or at least feels like it's going to hurt? And what do I need to do to get that conversation on the roster for this week or for even today?
Yeah. Yeah. More good fodder for Rewire for sure. For sure.
Just Rewire.
Great, Nick. No? Yeah. I would say that that everything that we've been talking about and everything you represent through the book and your life is very much about commitment to just changing your insides. That's the only, you know, if we can't change that, we have no chance at helping anybody.
Mm-hmm. You know,
change our hearts, change our guts, and rewire our reality, whatever which way you want to put it. And there comes a point where you realize, which is another nice quote from your book, which we can kind of end by, and it's by Franz Kafka, a Kafkaesque quote.
Mm-hmm.
From a certain point onward, there is no longer any turning back. That is the point that must be reached. And if everybody out there would realize that once you bring this kind of awareness and, you know, really looking at yourself inside and looking at all of these motivations and looking to want to change, to rewire, once you realize that that's happening and that has been happening, you can't fall off at that point. You just can't, because you just don't want to become a schmuck again, basically. You want to do this, and you start to realize it's about, you're not just doing it for yourself, but you're doing it for whoever's around you and to the bigger world at large. So that one day you can actually maybe watch one piece of news and see President Trump and be able to send love. That may happen one day, but for the moment, probably best not to watch any news, because it's not going to happen that easy.
I love the idea of burning your bridges. You know, there's like all kinds of burn the bridges behind you, because then all you can do is walk forward. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's a terrible sort of example of this, because it sort of flies in the face of the subject matter a little bit, but it's kind of, you know, it's a beautiful black and white kind of a situation. Is you know, the famous quote by was it Cortez who said burn the ships? You know, because him and the conquistadors landed on the shores, and he wanted to make sure that no one was going to turn around. You know, no one was going to leave. There was no option besides to move forward. Now, obviously, terrible things happened because of that. But the idea behind it is interesting. It's like, you know, when you burn the bridges behind you, all you can do is step forward. And, you know, I'm not saying that you should necessarily, you know, take all options away from yourself. But the idea of stepping forward into the unknown and not looking back, I mean, what can you do to make sure you're going to commit to the path? You were saying before about how this whole thing is about turning your insides out and cleaning things up. I mean, it's interesting. It is that way. And I think a big tool for me on that path has been self-forgiveness. Like I've said it before, like, how do you forgive yourself when you fall off? Invariably, we all do. We all do things that are not necessarily, you know, in accordance with our highest ideals.
Yeah.
And especially with children. I think you and I might have talked about this before. You know, when you have children, and you know, one of the biggest hangups for me has been, you know, and I'm kind of over it at this point, but for a while was, you know, man, I thought I'd be better at this. You know, wow, I thought I was going to be so much better at this. And it just turns into this beautiful opportunity for self-forgiveness. And it just kind of applies to all the things we've been talking about. It's like, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to be human. And ultimately, you just got to learn how to forgive yourself and keep on moving.
Yeah, absolutely. And without that, you can't forgive anybody else. You can't have that tough talk with anybody that you've wanted to have. So yeah, it all starts with ourselves. It really does. Sacred Science, The Sacred Science, An Ancient Healing Path for the Modern World, Nick Polizzi. You can get that anywhere, anytime, right now. Go to Amazon. You can get it there, I'm sure. And you can go to sacredscience.com.
Mm-hmm.
.com.
The Sacred Science.
The Sacred.
Actually, if they go to thesacredscience.com/new book, they'll get the book and also a ton of bonuses.
Oh, okay. There you go. And join, you know, get on the mail list. And Nick does all kinds of great things. And he's got quite a wonderful community there that Ram Dass and Love Serve are, we're hooked up with, and we do stuff together. So I appreciate you being here, Nick. Love you.
Yeah. Honored.
I
honored
love what
to
you
be
do.
Here.
Yeah.
Thank you, great. Man. Likewise. We're, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, just being able to hang out and chat with you is a true honor.
Well, it's a gift that we can do this. So I'm really happy. And, oh, by the way, Nick is doing stuff on Be Here Now Network. He's doing a podcast and a guest podcast was just done. Who did you do it with?
Dennis McKenna. Dennis McKenna.
Oh, Dennis.
Yeah. Brother of the famous Terrence McKenna, but also just an incredible human being himself.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, he's an ethnopharmacologist. He has this new work he's putting out right now. It's all about the coevolution of humans and plants. Honestly, if I could just sit in a room and read his books for, you know, like a week straight, there's enough material there to keep you enthralled. And it really makes a very scientific and also a sacred spiritual case for plant intelligence and how they basically set the stage for us, us vertebrates, and are still probably the ones who are calling the shots, even though we don't realize it.
Yeah. No, Dennis is great. We did something with him a couple of years ago. So Nick is going to, from time to time, he's going to give us, because he talks to some really great people, and we're happy to put it out on Be Here Now Network. So thanks again, Nick Polizzi, and we shall see you next week on Mind Rolling. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com.